This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The gap between the wealthiest Americans and the rest of the population is getting wider. A report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says the top 10% in America have more than three-quarters of the nation's wealth, and that wealth translates to political power. It's an issue that's made its way into the presidential race.
What we have today is a system in which billionaires are able to buy elections, a system in which the Koch brothers and a handful of other billionaires will be spending some $900 million in this campaign cycle in order to elect candidates who will represent the wealthy and the powerful. That is not democracy. That is oligarchy. We will not accept that.
On today's program, we're going to talk about the ways in which money influences politics and get a better sense of the power that the top 1% has in the United States. We'll start with Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her most recent book is called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And she's with us today on The State of Things. Jane Mayer, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start where your book starts, a scene in Indian Wells, California, after President Obama is inaugurated in 2009. What's going on? What's the significance of that meeting?
So Obama has just been elected and is just moving into the White House, basically. And while the nation is focused on that, a small group of some of the richest people in the country who are conservatives, who regard his election as a calamity, got together and started to plan how they could use their fortunes to fight back. And basically what came out of that meeting was a blueprint for how they were going to try to undermine everything Obama was aiming to do and in some senses nullify the popular election by using their money to, in many cases secretly, attack what the Obama administration was going to do.
How are they going to do that?
Well, what they did was they set up a number of organizations that looked like charities. So they were 501c3s and 501c4s, and they used these organizations that looked like they were kind of social welfare groups and educational groups to actually, they filled them with money, and then those groups ran ads, mobilized grassroots people, upset people like many of the early Tea Party people were associated with this effort, and riled people up. They used their funds and their paid professional organizers to rile people up against Obama and often to give them a lot of misinformation about what Obama was really doing.
Tell us about the organizers, Charles and David Koch, and why they would be so interested in this. Maybe we should also say a word about Koch Industries, which is the source of their wealth.
Okay. Well, the hosts of this meeting in Indian Wells in 2009, in January, really, just as Obama was getting inaugurated, were Charles Koch and David Koch. They are two of four brothers known as the Koch brothers. Those two brothers are two of the richest people in the world. They each are worth about $45 billion. Between them, they own most of the company known as Koch Industries. They've often joked that it's the biggest company nobody's ever heard of, and there's a reason for that. It's privately owned by them, and so there are no shareholders or public meetings about it. And it is a behemoth. Many people in America buy their products without knowing anything about where they're coming from. But Koch Industries is predominantly, it began as an oil refining company, and it had pipelines, so it's in the energy business. They've got coal mines, they've got gas, but they've also got, they bought at some point the Georgia Pacific Lumber Company. So they make tons of the lumber and paper in the country. They make Dixie cups, they make Vanity Fair napkins. They make tons of chemicals, Stainmaster carpet, Lycra. If you wear Lycra, you are buying a Koch Brothers product. It's incredible how many things it's into, and it has done phenomenally well. Charles Koch is one of, he's not just one of the richest people in the world. He and David are tied for about fifth most wealthy in America. But he's also one of the smartest people in the country. He's a phenomenal businessman. But what's interesting about him is he's an ideological zealot. there aren't that many people in American politics whose views are as far out and as tightly held as his views are.
Actually, to the right of Ronald Reagan, his political career begins in 1980, not 2008, right?
That's absolutely right, and it's so interesting because in 1980, Charles, who's the older brother of David, got David to run as vice president on the Libertarian ticket against Reagan because they thought Reagan was too liberal and was a sellout. And what they wanted was practically no government at all, and they come from a very distinct strain of American politics. Their father was one of the founders of the John Birch Society, and so they were so far right that in that 1980 election they got something like 1% of the whole vote, even though they spent millions of their own money. And what's interesting to me, and what this book tells the story of, is how did these two brothers go from so far out on the political spectrum that they got less than 1% of the vote to the point where they are now. I mean, that was 1980, so you were talking like 40 years ago, whatever, and they have gone from that point to now where their views and their money are at the center of the Republican Party. They've really bought an incredible amount of power by investing it smartly.
Well, all right, and let's stay right there. And again, that meeting in 2000, immediately after the Obama election or the Obama inauguration. Okay, a bunch of millionaires and billionaires get together and they decide what's in their best interest. What about if a bunch of liberals got together and said, hey, we don't like the Bush administration and where it's headed. Let's come up with a strategy for undoing what we think they're about to do and come up with a strategy that's more progressive and more in line with our... I mean, so what's wrong with a bunch of people getting together and aligning their thought and aligning their resources?
And there are liberals who've gotten together in a group called Democracy Alliance. It's nowhere near as successful. They're spending something like, I think they hope their budget will be $40 million this year. The group, excuse me, that the Kochs has assembled, which is about between 400 and 500 of the richest conservatives in the country, has a budget that they want to spend in the 2016 election cycle of $889 million. No one's ever seen anything like it. And so what is wrong with it? Well, to some extent, I think it raises really serious questions that your show is aiming to take a look at, which is, at what point is there a tipping point where money is so unequal in the country that a very small minority of people with minority views that serve their own interests, at what point do you have to worry that they can, by putting their money together, overwhelm the democracy so that you've got a, and it's not a new question. I mean, this is something Americans have been grappling with almost from the start, but there's always been a tension between the powerful minority and the broad majority. And I think what we're looking at and what I worry about as a political reporter is that we may have reached a point where people with very extreme views whose politics really is serving their own private interests may overwhelm the public interest. And that's one concern, and the other is that so much of this money is now being spent in secret so that the public can't really see it. And I think that raises even more troubling questions. That's why the book's called Dark Money, because right, this is specifically about hidden money.
A lot of that money has been spent in North Carolina with the help of a man named Art Pope, who is also a part of this group that the Koch brothers have put together. What part does he play?
He's actually a fascinating character, and you're right. He's a very important member of this gang, which many people, including myself, refer to as the Koch Network. I interviewed somebody who used to work with Art Pope, and he describes him as sort of the Koch brothers light. He is a sort of a mini-me state-sized version of what the Koch brothers are doing nationally, and he's known them for a long time. Art Pope, as you know better than I, is someone who runs a company called Variety Wholesalers. It's kind of five and dime stores. It's a chain of them that's been very successful up and down the East Coast, particularly in the South. And it was, again, another private company, family started by his, it was run by his father, but I think it was actually started by his grandfather.
His grandfather, 1930.
And so Art Pope has a family fortune, and he too has devoted it to promoting his ideology and trying to put politicians who he approves of in office in North Carolina. And he's used his money very artfully, so to speak, and strategically, and often secretly also to try to elect the officials he wants and flip the state. It's, you think of North Carolina as a state that goes back and forth between Democratic and Republican, and it often is a mix. But he's pushed it far towards the Republican column in recent years.
Well, we'll talk about how he did that, the 2010 election, Art Pope and the Koch brothers, and the question of oligarchy. Are we there? That's our question today on The State of Things. My guest now is Jane Mayer. She'll stay with us. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her book is called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Just ahead, we'll examine whether or not we have already become an oligarchy, and we'll do that on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, spending the hour talking about the 1%, the influence of big money in politics. Jane Mayer is still with us. She's staff writer for The New Yorker. Her book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And joining the conversation now is Jeffrey Winters. He's a political science professor at Northwestern University. He specializes in comparative politics and the author of the book Oligarchy. Jeffrey, welcome to The State of Things.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Frank.
Good to have you here. We should talk about, this is a word now that's made its way into the political discourse. We should probably start by actually defining it. What do we mean when we say oligarchy?
Yeah, oligarchy refers to the power of wealth. A lot of people think that it's just rule by the few, but if we go all the way back to Aristotle, the core of the definition was that a tremendous concentration of wealth was in a few hands, and everybody else divided up what was left. And oligarchy referred to the use of wealth power to dominate politics. And one of the key things throughout history that the wealthy have been forced to do is defend their wealth position because there are potential threats. If you have a tremendous concentration in a few hands, there are a number of directions from which threats can occur. One is from other oligarchs, and throughout history, that's actually been one of the biggest threats oligarchs faced, taking each other's wealth by forming small armies and taking over land and so on. But also from below, so the have-nots have posed threats, and also once states got formed of the kind that we're familiar with today, governments, there is the predatory role that states play. They can tax, they can redistribute. So throughout history, oligarchy has really been the politics of trying to defend concentrated wealth in a few hands.
Let's talk about and the fact that it is an issue and something worth thinking about. I mean, the fact that Aristotle is talking about it means that this has been a public issue for a long, long time. It's not just something people lived with. It was something they thought about and worked with. Let's go back to the Roman Empire and talk about how it played out in the Roman Empire. And I guess wealth was expressed in different ways. But let's go back to the Roman Empire.
Yeah, so if we one of the most startling things that people realize when they look at wealth concentration going all the way back to the ancient period compared with now is actually how much more concentrated wealth is now. So if we go back to the Roman Empire, if you take, for example, the 500 top Roman senators, and mind you, the Roman Empire was not a democracy, it was a dictatorship. Democracies, other than a brief period in Athens, don't really arise until a few hundred years ago in this world. But at that time, the top 500 senators of Rome had about 10,000 times the wealth of the average person in the Roman Empire. And that average person was either a slave or a landless farmer. And that's an incredible multiple. But if you take the median wealth of the average person in America today and you compare it with the top 500 Americans, that ratio is actually over 50,000 to 1. So then produces a puzzle for us. How could wealth be so much more concentrated now under democracy? than it was under dictatorship thousands of years ago. And this gets to the point that there's an interplay in the United States between democracy and oligarchy.
Well, Jane Mayer, let's talk about the ways in which, you know, Jeffrey talks about a problem for the oligarchs is defending their wealth. And one of the ways, you know, they have to defend themselves against a pitchfork rebellion, a rebellion from below, but also the state and the state sort of wanting a piece of what they have for public works and that sort of thing. Tell us what it is that the Koch network thinks it's defending its wealth from and how they operate, and particularly their views on government and public works.
Well, of course, one of the things they do is they don't define it as defending their wealth. One of the first strategies is always to portray their politics as something that's good for everyone, because it's not a popular place to begin by saying that they represent their own self-interest. So instead, they say they represent prosperity, and the organization, the biggest of the Koch's political organizations that's sort of a grassroots one, is Americans for Prosperity. It's not called Americans for the Prosperous. It's as if it's going to spread prosperity to everyone. So what does it actually advocate? If you take a close look at it, it advocates for lower taxes on the top earning people in the country, the abolition of the estate tax, which then allows for the super rich to pass on their wealth to the next generation. It advocates for a very weak state. A federal government is a strong federal government is a threat to super oligarchs. Both the Justice Department that can crack down on abuses that they might, you know, engage in, and for instance, a strong environmental protection agency that can crack down on the kind of pollution that the Koch Industries has been accused of over the years. That kind of government, and a strong activist government, can redistribute wealth and can hold those companies in check. And that, so they, what they advocate for is a very weak, almost next to nothing, they call it small government. And they say it's good for everyone, but if you take a close look, it's definitely good for them.
Well, Jeffrey, this goes back a long, long time. Didn't start with the Koch brothers. I think maybe you write about the back in the 19th century and the argument over income taxes beginning in 1894. And I think some of the issues that Jane points to are illustrated in that example.
Yeah. In fact, in the early 1890s, a movement got underway to try to raise taxes in the United States by a federal income tax. And it turns out that this was a major constitutional issue, but it got passed in the United States. Both the lower and the upper house passed a very modest income tax, actually. We're talking about not much more than 1% or 2%. And what was interesting about that income tax was that it was exclusively on like 0.5% of the population at the top. The exemption was so high that it really was only a tax on the wealthy. Immediately the next year, 1895, the Supreme Court struck down this federal income tax, and it took 18 years for mobilized Americans to actually change the rules of the game, because once the Supreme Court has intervened, the only thing you can do is basically change the Constitution. So what they did was they passed the 16th Amendment in 1913, and then once again, an income tax was reintroduced, and again, it was on just a sliver of the top 1% of Americans. And so this battle, right, between a democracy trying to raise funds, for example, from the very rich and trying to use those funds for the common good has been resisted vigorously. And things like the Supreme Court all the way up until today, with decisions like Citizens United a few years back, the Supreme Court has very often, as a very small group, which is not terribly democratic, has intervened to defend the very wealthy. And in Citizens United, it opened up the door for basically saying, money is part of your voting power.
Well, and even before that, in the Roosevelt administration, the very wealthy came up with an ingenious strategy to get some supporters, to keep them so that it wasn't just the 1% that were battling against taxes. They just got more people paying taxes. Tell us about what happened during the Roosevelt administration.
Well, right. So one of the think of it like this. The taxation starts in the early 20th century, and it falls at the federal level almost exclusively on the very rich. Then one of the strategies of the wealthy over the course of the 20th century was to move those taxes onto other strata, onto other groups in society, to push them off themselves and make everyone else pay them. And that's been a pretty effective strategy going all the way back to the 1930s and 1940s. What Jane was just saying a moment ago about how why is small government and even getting rid of the IRS, why is that such an important strategy for people like the Koch brothers or Art Pope or others? It's because they see all the welfare policies, all the policies having to do with redistributing education, health care, other kinds of things like that as being the taking of their money for the rest of America, and they simply don't agree with that process. And they have been very powerful in fighting against it.
In many cases, I describe a number of families in my book, these billionaire families. In many cases, the same families who are really big in right-wing conservative politics today, spending their money to try to get what they want politically, the same families were the early opponents of the income tax. This has been a multi-generational fight in these families,
well,
and they've really never accepted it. And so you've got families like the Mellons, and one of the people I write about is Richard Mellon Scaife, a member of the Mellon family. And when his great uncle was Treasury Secretary, he in the earlier part of the 20th century, he just spent all of his time trying to get rid of the income tax. I mean, this is, you know, it's an ideological fight for them, but it's a very personal fight for them.
Regulation, because all of these companies have been fined millions for breaking the law. I mean, I think, was it Charles Lewis at the Center for Public Integrity? You quote him in your book saying the Kochs are on a whole different level. They have a pattern of law-breaking, political manipulation, and obfuscation. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, if you keep breaking the law and getting fined, eventually you'd like to get the cops off your beat, right? I mean,
well, absolutely. And so they want to see, and they're very involved in the criminal justice reform movement now, but part of it is they would really like to see a much weaker Justice Department. And they've always, you know, this is where they've been from way back. They don't want the government interfering and limiting their power and wealth. And, you know, I mean, so for them, the government is the enemy. And what's interesting is they've managed to convince so many middle class people and working class people that this is in their interests, too. Even the people who you know, benefit from some of the same welfare programs and public schools that the middle class needs.
How have they done that? And maybe we'll talk about the think tanks and some of the not just direct political action, but behind the scenes work to shape the way we think about issues. How has the Koch network played a part in that, Jane?
Well, there's this thing that people call the Kochtopus. It was actually a term that came up from the right wing, actually, about the Kochs. And what it defines is this vast array of organizations that look like they're independent, all of which are funded by the Kochs and some of their fellow, super rich right wing allies. Money's flowing into them, and it is creating public opinion. So you have everything from talk show hosts who they pay off to all kinds of think tanks to university and programs and college professors programs to the sort of armies of people going door to door for Americans for Prosperity, who all of whom are pushing the Koch's message, which is in essence that the government is evil and that the government our elected government is really the American people's enemy. And so they just, you hear it over and over. It's a drumbeat, and eventually it shapes a lot of public opinion.
Jeffrey, talk about, too, the wealth defense industry, because, again, part of that message is that the government promotes these wasteful programs. Your tax dollars are being wasted on these programs and scofflaws who get away with cheating the government. And then there's the wealth defense industry that is a multi-billion dollar industry devoted to helping people not pay taxes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's, you know, one of the first points I want to make is that we need to remember that in the interaction between participation power, democracy in America, and oligarchic power, there have been periods where the American people, when organized, have done very well in getting policies passed that put greater tax burdens on the rich and lesser burdens on themselves. So, for example, coming out of the Second World War into the 50s and 1960s, what is almost unimaginable today, which is the highest incremental tax bracket being almost 90%, which is an incredible gap from where it is today. These were tremendous policy successes from a democratic sort of community point of view. And as they faced those very high tax rates, the demand among oligarchs in the United States for wealth defense was at its peak in the 50s and 60s. And it was just at this moment when a new private sector industry arose basically to serve their interests. So one of the interesting things is that it isn't really that the oligarchs themselves organize this part of it. What Jane is describing, which is very accurate, is, you know, the actual institutionalization of power like the Koch brothers. But what sort of precedes them is a private sector response. So I'm talking about lawyers, accountants, wealth management firms of all kinds. And what they do is they begin to specialize in moving money offshore, in creating things called tax opinion letters, which are ways of getting around the 78,000 pages of tax code that the United States has, which, by the way, this industry also played a role in writing and making complex and making it so that the IRS does not even understand the tax policies that are so complicated. So this industry arises, and one component of it is the ideological component, the funding of think tanks and so on. But another part of it is just a 24/7 around the year efforts to make sure that the wealthy don't pay very much of the actual tax bracket that they're in, and to reduce those tax brackets. But the average American has nothing comparable on their side. That's really important. So this is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's very, very effective at reducing what is called the effective tax rate.
So what you get are the people, you know, for instance, people will remember in the 2012 election when Romney's taxes were made public. He paid like 12 or 13% of his income in taxes, and yet he had a stupendously huge income. And what that does then, because there's so many different loopholes that the super rich are able to take advantage of, that this industry that Jeffrey Winters is describing has helped carve all these loopholes and make all these complications. And what happens then is a lot of the tax burden, instead of being paid by the very, very richest people in the country, gets shifted onto the shoulders of the kind of the middle class, really, upper middle class and the middle class, which then creates a lot of pressure on them and a lot of anger.
Right.
Often because they resent how expensive the welfare state is.
Easy to marshal their support against taxes when they're the ones who are actually paying it, and the guys who are whipping them up into a frenzy are getting up. Tell us briefly. I want you to talk about the tax opinion letter, Jeffrey, because I was shocked to hear about it.
Yeah. One quick thing on the tail end, though, of what you just said, which is that, you know, Jane mentioned this anger and so on. Not only are the tax burdens shifting downward, but the people who are in those lower brackets are very aware that the people above them are not paying taxes. So that just sort of makes them feel like the system is structured against them, and so they want to get rid of it. Now, a tax opinion letter is something that most people have never heard of. And one of the reasons you've never heard of it is most of us are called, or what I call, turbo taxpayers, meaning you go out and you buy some software, you try to get through the 1040. It asks you things like, did you move? Did you, you know, trying to find little deductions you can get. The tax opinion letter is a whole nother world. This is a tailored, specialized letter written just for you by tax lawyers and accountants. The average cost of a tax opinion letter is about $3 million. Yeah.
This better save me a lot of money.
Well, right. Now, the savings you can get from a tax opinion letter can range from $10 million to $300 million in a single tax year. So it's very worthwhile for you to get a tax opinion letter. And what a tax opinion letter is simply this. It basically is a letter that says your non-payment of these taxes is justified in the tax code in the following way. And then the tax opinion letter specifies all of that. Now, if you are later challenged by the IRS for your non-payment of taxes, one thing that comes with your $3 million fee for the tax opinion letter is that the firm will defend you against the IRS. Now, there's a line in the manual of the IRS that says, before you go after someone for taxes, take into consideration what they call the litigation risk. That is, can people defend themselves? And so if they can, back off and go after average Americans.
So if you're well-heeled and well-defended, back off. It's going to cost us too much. I'm going to take a break. Jane Mayer is with us. Jeffrey Winters. We're talking about oligarchy in America, and we will continue our conversation after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Jeffrey Winters, a political science professor at Northwestern University, author of the book Oligarchy. Also with us is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And Jane, in 2011, you wrote a piece that turned some heads here in North Carolina, and I suspect around the country. Look back at the 2010 election here, a pivotal election in North Carolina, and a profile of Art Pope and his influence in the state. Tell us about the Red Map Project.
Well, Red Map was actually a very successful project that a few Republicans dreamed up to try to figure out what could they do at a point when Obama was really quite popular. How could they take power back for the Republican Party? And what they did was they looked around the country and realized the smartest move would be to try to take over state legislatures, and where they could flip them from Democratic control to Republican control, because 2010 was an important year for state legislatures. Every 10 years, there's a new census, and that was the census year, which allows the legislatures to redraw congressional districts and gerrymander them, as they call it. And so by flipping the legislatures with a small amount of money in many different states, they could try to put Republicans in charge of redrawing those congressional districts. And one of the places that they put the most energy into this project was your own state, North Carolina.
Yeah, and it was highly successful, and I think nobody saw it coming. We talk about maybe the race involving Jon Snow, a very conservative Democrat, often voted for Republicans. He was a state senator, unseated. Talk about that race and the amount of money that was spent on a really vicious campaign against Jon Snow.
Well, and what was interesting about Red Map was it was a great example of this dark money. An awful lot of the money went from big donors like the Kochs and like Art Pope and into these outside groups that nobody had ever really heard of before, with these very anodyne names that seemed kind of like, what is that? And they started putting ads up on the air and attacking local officials who, like Jon Snow, became unrecognizable only in the way these ads portrayed them. It was someone who was actually quite tough on law and order, and he was defined as someone who was going to let murderers and rapists out on the street. And I think probably those ads scared a lot of people. It was a very tight race in the end, but I think many people, including Jon Snow, think that outside money, that secret money, made the difference. And it happened all over your state.
And it's legal money, Jeffrey. I mean, I think that's part of it. And you argue that primary elections are really important
times when money power comes into play. And again, we don't know where it comes from, and there's a lot of it that comes from out of state.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary election period in the United States, and it happens to be extraordinary for a couple reasons. One is, as Jane said, not only at the state level but at the national level, we have players openly using their wealth power, like the Koch brothers, in a way that is really new. So the money's actually often been hidden in the past. So there's this thing that political scientists and others call the wealth primary. So long before anybody else gets to go to a primary and actually cast a vote, candidates run around and go to $30,000 a plate dinners and try to sell their ideas and their platforms to the very rich. And then if they get through that process, then they get to be one of the contenders. This is at the national level. They get to be one of the contenders that eventually voters get to choose among. And so there is a point at which we do actually have some democratic role in this. But think of the wealth primary as being a kind of vetting of the candidates to make sure that candidates who are threatening to the very rich do not actually make it onto the ballot. And occasionally... and this is what's also extraordinary about this year. Not only do we have an oligarch himself running at, you know, Romney was a very minor oligarch compared to Trump, who's in the billionaire level. But we also have a backlash going on in the United States in the form of Bernie Sanders. This is someone who is doing what we call raising money by micro donations. Barack Obama did this as well. But the difference between Barack Obama, who managed to eclipse Hillary Clinton, is that he started with micro donations, but as soon as he got on the radar screen, he turned to massive money, which is the common thing to do. Bernie Sanders has actually pledged that he will never turn to big money, which raises the question, can you crowdsource the $1 billion to $1.2 billion it is expected to be able to cost to get to the White House? Can you do that? That's never been done in the United States. And one more quick point on the end of this is that notice the open role that oligarchic money is playing in this election. Here's an example. As Donald Trump is moving forward, the whole country is sort of, and the media are saying, please, oligarchs, jump in with your big money and block him. That's our only hope. Will the Koch brothers and others please come in with your massive money and stop this man? Because we don't feel like at the Democratic level we're able to do that.
Well, I mean, what do you make of that? Because here, I mean, he is an oligarch, but he is not a member of the Koch Pope Club. Quite clearly, Scott Walker, his guy in Wisconsin, the Koch brothers, you know, a close associate of the Koch brothers in Wisconsin. Wisconsin appears to be going for Cruz. Clearly not a Koch player and yet an oligarch who's on his own. What does that say about
So basically what you had was in the beginning on the Republican side, every one of the major Republican presidential candidates went to the Kochs confab. They meet twice a year with their other mm-hmm. donors where they sort of audition for the backing of these big
exactly.
super donors. And so you had them, everyone but one, and the one that didn't go was Trump. And Trump has been very clever because what he's done is he's portrayed himself as the uncorruptible oligarch. He couldn't be where he was if he wasn't spending a ton of his own money, which he is. But the public sees him as not bought by others, which thus makes him seem, you know, less corrupt. And so you've got the others who all went there, and some of whom got some backing. The truth is, the Kochs themselves don't really get involved very often in presidential primaries. They were waiting to see whoever gets the nomination and then back that, and that's how they usually do it. But so you've got this extraordinary picture going on of the of one guy, Trump, spending his own way towards the White House, and people pronouncing him uncorrupt because he's not owned by other billionaires.
Well, and even more charming, the ability to say, and yet I have played the game, and when I've seen it from the inside, it's so corrupt, I know it needs to change, as we hear in this exchange during the campaign. Let's listen.
You've also donated to several Democratic candidates, Hillary Clinton included, Nancy Pelosi. You explained away those donations, saying you did that to get business-related favors. And you said recently, quote, when you give, they do whatever the hell you want them to do.
You better believe it.
So what specifically did they do?
If I ask them, if I need them, you know, most of the people on this stage I've given to, just so you understand, a lot of money.
Not me.
Not me. But you're welcome to give me a check, Donald, if you'd like.
Many of them.
Actually, to be clear,
that's
he
right.
supported not, Charlie Crist.
Not Mike.
Gave Charlie
but
Crist.
Donald, if you end your campaign, I hope you will give to me.
Good.
Okay.
Sounds good. Sounds good to me, Governor. I will tell you that our system is broken. I give to many people. Before this, before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me.
So what'd
and you that's
get?
A broken system.
So what'd you get from Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi?
Well, I'll tell you what. With Hillary Clinton, I said, be at my wedding, and she came to my wedding. You know why? She had no choice because I gave. I gave to a foundation that, frankly, that foundation is supposed to do good. I didn't know her money would be used on private jets going all over the world. It was.
There you go. There we go. The reform smoker, the oligarch on the wagon, right? I mean, I crawled in the belly of the beast, and now I've seen how bad it is, and I'm here to tell you I'm going to change it.
You know, this it's not unlike other oligarchical leaders around the world who've gotten into power. If you look at what Berlusconi in Italy told people when he was running for office, it was, you know, I am the one who's going to clean up the corruption because I've seen the corruption. So I think it's a pitch that's been tried and worked elsewhere in the world. We'll have to see if it works here. But one of the things I wanted to say about the big money in this year's election, which I think people have to keep in mind, because there's been a lot of saying, well, Jeb Bush had, you know, tons of money, and Rubio had tons of money, and they didn't get anywhere, so money doesn't really have any impact. The truth is, the place where money has the least impact is the presidential race, private money, that is, because it's so expensive, it gets diluted, and also the whole thing is so public that there's all this free publicity. And so the public can follow it, and it's you can't really control it just by spending. Whereas at the local level, the state level, money goes so much further. And that's kind of what you've seen in North Carolina, where not that much money that's been spent by Art Pope and his family and his company and a few other people has really packed a wallop.
And we're talking about politics, but let's talk about academic centers and universities. That has been really a serious focus of the Koch brothers and Art Pope in this state. Jane, tell us about that.
Well, this is the thing that I also think people have to keep in mind is that this kind of spending from a few people with extraordinary wealth has been aimed not just at elections. Sometimes they win elections, sometimes they lose elections. But what there's been is a 40-year plan by a group of families to really change the way America thinks in order to change the direction of American politics. And it's been a much bigger, more comprehensive effort than just to change who gets elected. There's been an effort to fund university programs in the last count I saw was 307 different colleges and universities to push free market theory, to try to bring up the next generation to believe that the government is kind of an evil force in the market. And so there's university programs, there are think tanks, there are all kinds of organizations on the street. There have been organizations that also aim at filling the courts with judges who will be sympathetic to this point of view, teaching law school programs that will teach lawyers to think a certain way. And also there's been a big effort in science, frankly. I mean, there's been a tremendous effort to change American public opinion on the subject of global warming by using private funds from people who are in the energy business to spread doubt about whether climate change is real. And you can really chart it and see that it's actually had an effect on public opinion. A number of political scientists have now done this. It's fascinating, but kind of scary.
How, Jeffrey, in the past, how important has public opinion been to oligarchies? And is that just a phenomenon, you know, of the modern age and the rise of the nation state and democracy and, you know, and print and mass media? Or has public opinion been important to oligarchs in history?
Well, public opinion has been extremely important. And throughout most of the 20th century, the view of most people in the United States was that the government was an instrument of change, that the government created not only infrastructure for all of us to use, but also helped create opportunities. There was an idea that you had to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, but that the role that the government would play via all kinds of public policies having to do with education and other things, loans, credit, these things were to give people who didn't have very many opportunities a chance. And so to change public opinion so dramatically into a view that only unworthy people get assistance and that government in general is a negative thing, is a massive change, and it does take decades, as Jane was saying, to do this. Could I connect this to foreign policy also? Because sure. We haven't really mentioned this. One of the things that also this view that has been throughout academia and public policy making in Washington and the Beltway is a view that the United States, across its foreign policy over the last 50 years at least, has focused on only two out of three important components. The two that it's focused on are making the world safe for the movement of capital and increasing trade, but not improving labor standards around the world. So if we had a much more progressive policy led by unions and people who had actually changed the working standards in the United States from being very harsh to much safer and better paying, we could have built into our post-war policy many more defenses of labor standards around the world. So we could have made it a condition for trading with countries, not just that they safeguard global capital as it moves around and moves industries to other countries, but also demands labor standards that are improved in those places so that Americans are competing with people on a fair basis. That has not been part of our foreign policy, and that is also a reflection of wealth power. They wanted to be able to move between countries and pit American workers against people in right. very oppressed circumstances.
Capital moves freely across the border. Labor does not. Yeah, and, of course, exactly. We have policies and now rhetoric that is violently opposed to that kind of freedom, which is one of the markets. So I've only got about 30 seconds left for each of you. Where are we going? As things get better? Is it the fact that Bernie Sanders is running a credible campaign and even Donald Trump speaks, you know, the fact that the parties and wealth don't seem to be holding their center? Is that a sign things are changing or is it just going to be business as usual? Well, Jane, let me start with you.
I think it's a very positive sign. I think if for a long time in Washington, where I'm based, people have said nobody cares about the issue of campaign finance and who spends money in politics. This year, those people are being proven wrong. This thing is hitting a nerve, and I think that the country's waking up to it, and people care very much about it. And that's got to be a good thing.
What do you think, Jeffrey?
I think that oligarchs are more visible than ever before, and that visibility to some of the smart money is making them nervous. And so there is a backlash. Americans are aware of the distorted level of money power, and that's an important trend. The way you take your democracy back is you put limits on the use of wealth power in the system.
I want to thank you both. Jeffrey Winters, a political science professor at Northwestern University and author of the book Oligarchy. Jane Mayer, staff writer for The New Yorker. Her latest book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.